This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, good. Yeah, we're short Jen. Jen had some power outages in the wild hills of rural Virginia. So, hey, that's we're going to make do without her, and then we'll have her do a solo next time, I think.
Yeah. Well, do you know what the weather's like in Virginia around this time of year?
Well, it's been snowy and cold and rainy and wind, so it's all been very exciting.
So I'm getting an impression. So Dr. Hawk was from Alaska, and then she moved to Seattle, and now she's in Virginia. She must like the snow a lot.
Yeah, I think so.
The cold weather. Yeah. Or she's not intimidated by
right,
the cold, like
that's what it is.
Soft California boy like
yeah,
I am.
Yeah, forget it. Snow for me, poison. It's like anthrax. All right. All right. Well, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. We got a couple of comments from last show about your sounding off on some of the things that might be going on in the world. So very interesting. What do you think? Did you get some comments and some emails?
I don't even remember what I said. What was I talking about?
We were talking about the Great Reset and the World Economic Forum and. Yeah. And Johns Hopkins study.
Oh yeah, the Hopkins study. Oh, I did get a response. Yeah, so I got a doctor contacted me and said, hey, you know, you probably have this wrong. I went back and looked at the Hopkins study. It wasn't peer reviewed. It's what's known as a working paper. I read down through it and. Looks very solid. Looks like a really well done meta-analysis. So I think all that's going to stand there. However, this doc did point something out. I had basically said the lockdowns are useless, the masks are useless, and the social distancing is useless. And the doc said, "Hey, careful. The masks may not be useless," and sent me some evidence indicating. That you know studies that have shown that the masks are useful. Except, let me clarify what my point was on this, and that is that as a policy, as a public policy, they are worthless. Now that doesn't mean that if you're hiding in your own basement, you know, with three masks on and making sure that nobody comes within 50 yards of you, you can defend yourself against coronavirus. And yeah, and it may be possible that you know these cloth masks are worthless, but it's possible that if you're extremely fastidious with an N95 mask in closed spaces with other people, there's very possibly that's useful. But it turns out that as a matter of practical policy, if you actually study the behavior quote in the wild, it's going to turn out to be worthless. So that was the point of this Hopkins study. And as I said, it wasn't a study per se. It's a meta-analysis of many studies. And so that's Jen had been looking at some of these very studies themselves, the independent studies, and saying they've been trickling in over the last year, all pointing in the same direction. So it's no surprise that the meta-analysis points that direction. Meta-analysis being a type of statistical technique that allows you to combine a whole bunch of studies to see that if there was a conflict between and the literature on alternative points of view of something, a meta-analysis can help indicate where the truth really is. In other words, if you have 35 studies on something and 32 are pointing one direction and three are pointing the other direction, it isn't that anybody's being dishonest. It's just that the three that are pointing the other direction are outliers. They are statistical outliers that are inevitable some kind of scientific observation is done honestly. The whole point is that that we use statistical analyses to define what is probably true by using the laws of probability. And that means that if we measure something enough times, we're going to find something that goes in the opposite direction. And so it's not a surprise if we have something that goes 32-3. And in this case, it looks very solid that all of this public policy crap that has gone on for the last couple of years has been one big pile of manure that has been worthless. So that's what that study indicates, and my look at that study hasn't changed my opinion on that. Anyway, so that's that.
I love it.
Yeah, so that's that, which is why, I mean, this is all you have to do, and many, we had previously talked about this, you know, a year ago, and that is that when you look at correlation coefficients for different types of policies, and then you look around the United States at, say, 50 different states or 50 different cities with very different policies, and then you see what the correlation coefficient is between the policy agenda that you're thinking is helpful and the correlation coefficient of death rates, infection rates, et cetera. When you find that the correlation coefficient is zero, then you know that there's no utility. And that's precisely what's been found. So mm-hmm. that was found a long time ago, and then this meta-analysis is once again pointing to the same facts. All right, well, that's enough. Yeah, that was the pushback we got. We got intelligent pushback and thoughtful, but my opinion stands that this has been a total utter fiasco, and it has been also, I believe, carefully and deliberately engineered in order to cause economic advantage for monopoly capital that is, you know, obviously heavily incentivized to push the political agendas that they pushed. So lots of little people have been crushed. A lot of people that are very worried and anxious and inherently germphobic have been clinging to the hope that if they did all these things right, that they would be somehow spared. And they've been also essentially misinformed into thinking that if everybody would do the same, then we'd all be safe, which has led to an absurd way of people being divided in this country on this issue. It's ingenious. This did not happen by accident. And it's a travesty to society and freedom that this has gone this direction. But hey, you know what? I think we'll survive it, and I think it'll work its way up. The truth will eventually grind its way somewhere to the forefront. So we got a ways to go on that, I think.
I'm reminded of a phrase you used one time on the podcast, by hook or by crook.
Yeah, that's an old one of my dad's. Yeah, by hook or by crook, we'll see the world right side up again at some point.
Thank you, Dr. Lyle. Really appreciate it.
And, all right. All right, Nathan, what else we got?
Curious about correlation coefficients. I know you gave a little brief overview of what correlation coefficients are in your talk at Chef AJ's conference a couple years ago, Kyle, called Not Your Trauma, Not Your Mama.
Right.
so I encourage people to go check that out. Okay, so let's get to some questions.
Sure.
Dear doctors, question today is jealousy and controlling or possessive behavior a sign that a romantic partner loves you, or is it just a something to do with their personality?
This is a good question for a lot of questions are good questions, because what they're doing is they're looking at an interesting characteristic of human nature. And you're seeing something there, and you're just not quite sure how to look at it. So what you're looking at is adaptations for mate retention. And so you can imagine that adaptations for mate retention that exist in all normal functioning humans, it's not going to probably, might not exist in some seriously autistic human. But in other words, giving a normal brain function that we would expect to find mate retention strategies embedded in the system. They are there. Okay. They're natural to the system. Now, so then they should also be context dependent, just in the same way that all people, normal people that feel hunger and thirst, but you don't feel hungry all the time. You don't feel thirsty all the time. They are context dependent mechanisms. And so you can imagine that it should be the case that if your glycogen stores are lower and you're lower on calories, you should be hungrier, all things being equal, than when you're not. That's how the system should work. And in the same way, you should feel desire, some jealousy, and a desire to mate guard your mate when you are under conditions of threat. And those conditions of threat, for example, would be in situations where your mate might be, you might perceive that your mate is more attractive than you are. And you also might perceive that your mate is potentially persuadable and poachable by other people. And there may be specific under other people that are attempting to poach your mate that you're able to observe, etc. So in other words, these would be conditions under which we would expect these instincts to be activated more intensively. So it's not a question of whether or not, you know, if they're possessive, they love me, and if they're not possessive, they don't, or that they that's, you know, that that's a better way of being. No, that's not true. In fact, this was a great question, because this question actually was one of the most important questions of my life. I was in a relationship early in life, a long-term relationship that I sort of thought I should have been in, and it was the right thing to do, it was the right person, etc., and everybody thought it was the right match. And the truth is that I wasn't into it. And I remember feeling zero possessiveness, and I remember reading in Harry Brown about the feelings of jealousy, and then those were indication that you're in the wrong place, and I was influenced by that, and that turns out to be wrong. So this is an example where, you know, someone is as outstanding and penetrating a vision as Harry Brown can not actually understand something. We now look to David Buss doing, you know, 20 years later, post How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World, David Buss publishing on the jealousy mechanism with his, you know, characteristic, just unbelievable precision of thought. And so so then I read that research, and then of course that made perfect sense. And so the notion is, if you are, if something is valuable to you and it's threatened, then you should feel the anxiety, and that there should be steps that you would take to defend it, whether or not it's your food that's being stolen from you, or your favorite bicycle, or your mate. So, and of course, the course of evolution, there would be a host of tactics that would get inscribed into the genetic code of humans, that would be there in order to defend a human against the very substantial loss of a mate when it could otherwise be defended. Okay, so what we should see in the best of relationships is some kind of a dynamic, in other words, it's changeable, but a dynamic balance where you are feeling comfortable a lot of the time, but then at times when you might be under situations of threat, then you feel the anxiety and you feel the potential desire to constrain your mate's behavior, constrain their access to the marketplace, constrain their access to a specific individual, etc. If you never feel a neuron of jealousy, you are undoubtedly in the wrong place. Okay, so I won't maybe that's a little too strong, but I don't think so. Okay. So I think that, and actually the research evidence supports this, what is a rather obvious hypothesis about how this would work. So if you feel so comfortable that you just really couldn't care less who your mate's talking to, what they're doing, et cetera, then I think it's that you don't care, that mate is not perceived by you to be that valuable. That isn't necessarily the worst thing if your life's comfortable. Maybe you're fine with this. But this is not the fingerprints of an excellent relationship that optimizes human happiness. Relationships that are excellent, that optimize human happiness, have a little edge to them. Your mate may do things that make you feel very secure, and therefore you may not feel like you need to be controlling or have much jealousy mechanism activated, but it's likely to be the case that there are times when that does happen. And in very good relationships, sometimes when that happens, that is to the delight of the partner. Okay. And then it's like, I'll be darned. That made you jealous? How exciting is that? It's like there is no reason to be jealous, i.e. I'm not defecting. I wasn't thinking of defecting. However, it's good to know that you consider me to be that valuable. And so the answer to the question is there should look like some balance of this in here that makes sense. Mostly feeling secure with a little hint of periodic anxiety under certain circumstances, that would be, you know, the best place for a relationship to, that would be diagnostic of a relationship that is probably about as good as it gets.
Would you have a comment about if a mate gets a little annoyed if the other mate's being jealous?
Let's see. Let me think about that. It depends on, let's suppose, for example, that this is an annoying process because it happens over and over and over. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now we're talking about, and let's suppose, for example, that there really isn't any good objective reasons that we can see. In other words, the mate that is getting, that is the object of this sort of jealousy, really isn't having their heads turned and really isn't, in that space, and now they're getting annoyed. Mm-hmm. Well, that's either a derivative of the fact that person number one is feeling substantially over rewarded and therefore they're under threat, even though the mate number two doesn't feel that way. but that could be actually objectively true. And so even though that's an annoying situation for mate number two, and it's an anxiety-provoking situation for mate number one, that is a situation that there could be objective evidence that mate number one is reading that actually makes that, it's chronically activating that instinct. It could also be the case that this is, quote, personality. In other words, so mate number one simply has a particularly active jealousy organ. They got a little paranoid streak in there and a little disagreeable streak, et cetera, and a little unstable. So in other words, there's a constellation of personality characteristics that's making that instinct fire off when there is not any objective reasons why it's taking place. That is a personality issue, and that's going to, that will, you know, detract from the overall the overall value of the experience in that relationship. That's a quirk that person brings into relationships that are going to limit the amount of happiness that relationship can have. So that's actually an important, and that I think was a part of this question that underlying there. In other words, there are people that are in relationships where that characteristic, let's paint this picture. We could paint it either way because it could go either way. But let's say that we've got a male who feels over-rewarded, anxious, and is on edge. And the female thinks he's great. And she also, something about this, actually, she likes this because it's signaling to her that he finds her very valuable. So in the early going, it's kind of exciting and it's reassuring for the female that this is the process. However, now we're like 18 months in and now it's getting annoying. In other words, now it's no longer a great thing. It's just like, whoa, I have to call him. I have to make sure he knows where I am. You know, I have to turn on a tracker on my phone. And then he, you know, confronts me now and then, but really there's nothing going on because my head isn't being turned by anybody. It's like, this is now starting to, this is a personality limitation on the part of this guy, and he's not going to change. This is a pain in the ass. So, and now, you know, that will have an influence over what the quality of that a relationship experience is for both of them, but certainly for the female. So he may have to live in circumstances like that because that may be his personality. She doesn't. And there are women that need to grit their teeth and leave relationships with men that have essentially an overly dialed up paranoid chip. It's a pain in the ass. Gets really bad. You know, I've had to, on occasions, really help women devise escape strategies from stalking, clingy, crazy exes, where they had to, you know, they had to leave town, they had to get out, they had to leave job, leave home, leave, and get away from these people. So this is what we talk about when we say a balance of this, like how much is personality, how much is situation. There are circumstances where it's overwhelmingly personality and it's really bad. And dangerous, and you know it's essential. It's radioactive that you have to get the hell away from it. There are other situations where, if your mate evidences no jealousy mechanism at all towards you, you can feel that there's something very flat and insecure about the relationship. It's too nonchalant, and whether that's personality or whether it's situation, I would generally indicate that that is generally situation. The average normal human being has within them jealousy mechanism circuitry that will go off under circumstances when they are in relationships that they find highly valuable that come under threat. Okay, so if you are a highly valuable mate, and there will be times on occasion where you will do things that and be in circumstances that could cause your mate to be threatened. If you never see a neuron of threat inside that mate, then this is pretty flat. You're not seen as that valuable, and they're not that into you. So that's how I would draw that all out. You can just see it in sort of in your mind's eye. It's just a bunch of vector analysis is all that's taking place there. It's, you know, if a person's nonchalant about buying your car, they're not that into it. If they're falling all over themselves, you know, then maybe you're more valuable. Your car's more valuable than you thought it was. So, you know, this is all just car sales. At the end of the day, car sales will kind of tell us the story about what's going on inside of relationships.
Wonderful. Oh, I love it, Dr. Lyle. Thank you so much.
All right.
Well, speaking of relationships, our next question has to do with crystal clear and maybe not necessarily romantic relationships, but in general, the question is, dear doctors, does crystal clear usually only work with honest people? I suppose a dishonest person would lie and manipulate during the crystal clear discussion. Therefore, the best outcome of the conversation would be finding out the truth despite their dishonesty or terminating the relationship because of the realization of their dishonesty and that it carries too many costs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't hear a question there, but not exactly. But what I hear is good thinking, and that is that crystal clear is a useful general strategy for honest people to find out where on earth they're disagreeing and make sure they understand the nature of the disagreement, and for an honest person to smoke out the shiftiness in a dishonest person. Or a person that's behaving dishonestly with respect to a specific conflict. So either way, you know, that's it's a good thing. I use crystal clear over and over again with criminals that I was cross-examining about their crime. And it was super useful to, I learned crystal clear really from reading Vincent Bugliosi, the great criminal attorney. And I learned how carefully he would go after small details and continue to make sure that they were completely clear to him before he would go forward. And when I started to do that, what looked like very good stories of plausible deniability on the part of a criminal would fall apart under crystal clear. And so I learned that. I interviewed literally thousands of criminals under these kinds of circumstances. And that's how I developed a quiet, calm, relentless determination to just keep sitting right there on a question that I don't quite understand and make them articulate it until I do understand. And a lot of times, if I don't understand, the reason I don't understand is they're being deliberately deceptive. So crystal clear, crystal clear has an additional value that when you're really irritated at somebody, but it's somebody that you care about or that it's a relationship you care about and there's a significant conflict and you're thinking that they're being dishonest or somehow deceptive or they're being stubborn or they're being unreasonable, the very same kind of sort of calm discipline of crystal clear, we're going to begin at the beginning and let me just ask you, let me make sure I understand what's going on inside your head. I would say in my life, not that, I've used this a ton because I'm not in conflict very often, but I would say when I have done this, there has been a high percentage of the time, 3/4 or so or more, where the conflict actually will dissipate and go away upon closer inspection. In other words, now there was something about the reason why they were doing what they were doing that I did not see. And now that I see what they were thinking, the rest of their behavior makes sense. So again, good thinking on the part of this questioner. The crystal clear is a terrific, what it is it's just a calm, relentless, and determined seeking of the truth. Okay? And the truth will either lead us to two people not having such a bad conflict that they can't see each other's position and that they can reasonably compromise, or that we wind up head first into a situation where we have a very clear disagreement about what is fair and we have a very significant conflict of interest, and now we're going to need to negotiate that. You know, in whatever way it is that that could go all the way to a lawsuit or it could go to a parting of the ways, et cetera. But the point of it is that, again, crystal clear it's a triangulation on the truth so that we can understand what the nature is of the conflict of interest between two parties. So that's the point of it. And if we see that they're getting dishonest in it and we keep holding the laser to it, and we see the shiftiness, then we can start inferring that we're under deception for a reason, that they are protecting some position where they've got some, we've got some asset, something, we've got some control over something that they want. And that they know that they're not going to be able to trade fairly for it, so they're going to have to use deception. So so crystal clear is the obvious technique for getting right to the root of what those conflicts are, so that we can get down to it.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lyle.
All right, what else we got, Nathan?
Well, our next question is probably in a situation where maybe someone might want to use crystal clear. And it kind of goes to our first question about the male possessive or the jealousy and the controlling. Yeah. And so the question is actually, dear doctors, how common is it for men to be successfully deceived about a woman's promiscuity? And how easy is it for men to correctly sniff out a woman who's promiscuous? And how common is it for women to lie about their promiscuity?
Another good question, and we're going to, again, go take a wider angle look at sort of what's being asked more generally. So it's going to turn out that deception is a very core component of motivation. And so that's going to be true throughout the animal kingdom, and it's going to be true in people. So a predator has camouflage on them that is deceptive. They are attempting to deceive prey in many ways because they have a conflict of interest with the prey. There are three basic strategies for human beings to obtain resources from other humans. And those three ways are essentially free exchange. In other words, where it's value for value. Like I tell you what it is that I have in my picnic basket and you tell me what it is that you got in your picnic basket, and we trade. We trade the things that, you know, we take them out one at a time. I've got three apples, you've got three oranges, and we swap. So that's there's a little concept that sits under there. We might call it informed consent. In other words, we're doing these exchanges freely that we may want them badly. We may feel under pressure, but nobody's putting a gun to our head to make this trade. This is simply just an advantage that we can get if we give up something and get something back. So that's free trade. Force is where I put a gun to somebody's head and tell them, hand over the money. That's force. Okay. Fraud is where I trick somebody into buying my used car that I know has a bad transmission, but I put, you know, sawdust in the transmission or whatever it is that they used to do in the old days to make it feel like it's working fine. And then it turns out that the transmission blows apart in 90 days. So force, fraud, free trade. Those are the three ways that we can get the resources, i.e. we have an exchange process, which is the only thing that a relationship is. Relationships are exchange processes. So you have a relationship with the guy behind the counter at the bookstore. So you're under an exchange process, if only for a few minutes, for a minute or two. But in relationships where there's more substantial being exchanged, then obviously the stakes are going to be greater and the possible value of deception is going to be more. Now, deception, as we can see, that, you know, if you wanted resources, you want whatever resources you want, one way to try to get all the resources you can get your hands on is to take over the world. So you're going to be Klaus Schwab or Genghis Khan or whatever it is. In other words, you're trying to get
Bill Gates.
Control.
Oh, sorry, too soon.
Yeah, Bill Gates. No, that's fine. Yeah, same thing. In other words, they're trying to get control by some means other than free trade. So in the case, you know, force and fraud are two things that are extremely useful. And you can see that these would be three processes that the evolution would basically say, well, which is the best process for you to be using right now, all things considered. And so there's going to be conditions under which the average human being is going to say, well, the correct decision is force. That this is, you know, the lady's not getting out of the phone booth, and I've got to get in there because my phone's not working and I have to call. I have to make a serious call because if I don't get this call through, somebody's going to die. And she just keeps chatting and I keep waving at her and she won't get out. This comes out of a James Bond movie, Octopussy, you know, 20 years ago. So he just pulls her out of the phone booth. All right. Force. So there's going to be times when that's going to be the organism is going to calculate that that's the most effective thing that it can be doing with its time and energy is to use force to cause this a transaction to take place. Now, you know, these are ethical questions. You know, would you steal from the pharmaceutical guy, you know, the medicine that your dying mother needs if you didn't have enough money? It's like, well, you know, this is it all depends upon what you think your future mating processes would work. You know, who's going to live and who's going to die and who's going to get locked up and what's going to happen to your DNA. In other words, your brain is going to be running a complex cost-benefit analysis, and the ethicist can try to see how many, you know, issues can dance on the head of a pin. But the bottom line is that they're, you're calculating, you're attempting to, all things considered, try to figure out whether force is the optimum strategy. Now, you can imagine that if you're a big, strong, you're the biggest, strongest bully on the island, okay, and you got, you know, there's only 15 men on the island, and three of them are your big, strong brothers, and so between the four of you, you can terrorize everybody else, then there may be, it may be perfectly useful and successful to just use force. Just take what you want, okay? Now, in many conditions, that's not going to work very well. So the right thing to do, obviously, many conditions, most conditions are going to be that people are not going to be in a position to be using force or fraud very effectively. It's going to be expensive. You can go back to a Stone Age village. You can see situations where one big bully can't do that because then three guys are going to just set a trap for him, walk him into it, and then they're going to kill him. Because of the coordinated effort of smaller, weaker males, that they can work coordinatedly against a big, strong bully. Big, strong bullies don't get to do what they want. They can get some of what they want, and they can use the threat of force, you know, to some degree. But the bottom line is that humans, because of the possibility of coordinated action, are limited in what they can do when it comes to the use of force. Now, the energy conservation system is going to be ceaselessly trying to figure out how it can get a better deal than through free trade. So it's going to be using deception. It's going to be trying to trick people into making trades that they don't know that they're making. So this is, you know, rampant. This is going to be, this is why you have just unbelievable amounts of civil law, because we, you know, I said this, you said that, but, you know, you're saying that I said that, but I didn't say that. Look at how that word is used here. No, that isn't what I meant. It's like, well, if I had known that's what you meant, I wouldn't have made that trade with you. It's like, well, you did make the trade, and it is what it says, and too bad for you. Okay? Don't think that there isn't big money in those things. So deception is a long-standing process that if I can get you to make a trade with me and I can deceive you a little bit, I can get an advantage in the trade. Well, you can imagine that, of course, then it would be incredibly important to be able to detect deception. And so people are very good at that. In other words, they may not be good in a given flash instant, but over time, they're very good. So if you have these deals like, well, nobody could tell in the social psych experiment who lied to them about this or that. Oh, yeah, that's very interesting. And it's kind of nice social psych experiment. It shows you that there's conditions under which where the person who's being deceptive is being incentivized to try to get something past you. And the other person is incentivized to try to detect the deceit. And it turns out that the deception can be very, very effective. Okay, that's fine, but that isn't telling the whole story of human evolution, because you have something called memory. And the memory was, you and I made a deal, you said that you were going to do this, and I said I was going to do that, and I did my part, and then you didn't do your part. And now I remember it. Okay, so a big part of the check against the use of deception is memory. And you know, I have memories that go way back. I don't look like an elephant. I got a big nose, so I got a big trunk, okay? Yeah, I do look a little bit like an elephant. But the bottom line is I can remember back 50 years that people said something that they were going to do and then they didn't do it, and that recorded in my head. Not so trustworthy of an actor. I'll be on guard next time against that specific individual, okay? So this issue about women and their promiscuity and whether or not they can cloak it, you know, et cetera, and the men can be duped. The truth of the matter is that the men have ways of detecting that deception that are not, you know, they're not little flash instances. You're in a relationship with somebody, you can't tell where they are, they come back with a little bit tighter clothes. They're, you know, they, you meet up with them and they're wearing perfume and they usually don't, and they're looking a little too sharp.
Don't say them all, Dr. Lyle.
So in other words, your brains are built to be looking for all kinds of cues that look like you are being potentially deceived. And it turns out that in David Buss's research, that or maybe it's research he reports, but I believe he actually conducted this research, that in couples where one part of the couple believed that the other one was having an affair, in every single case, the other party was either having an affair or they were very close to having an affair.
Wow.
So the party that was suspicious was always right. That was an amazing study. That's one of those studies that stuck in my mind, you know, over the last 30 years as being really, really interesting. In evolution, can men detect females' promiscuity? Can they sniff it out? Yep, they can over time. Okay, can they be duped in the short run? Of course. Okay, the females have potential, and females and males. This is not so much about female promiscuity as it is about the abilities of humans to deceive each other for how long, under what conditions. And the fact that human beings have capabilities, it is so important to detect deceit that they have a lot of machinery in order to try to smoke it out. And on the other side, this is all about stakes. So it's an evolutionary arms race. In situations, for example, where someone has a great deal of incentive for deceiving you and you don't have that much of an incentive to detect the deceit, then you may be not able to detect it because there's been an asymmetry with respect to that specific behavior and set of circumstances that you don't have the machinery or not alert for that possible problem. I had a guy as an example, one of my guys in prison was very sharp character, sociopathic as hell. And he told me, yeah, he stole $500,000 and nobody knew it happened. Because it was all like $2.40 at a time on people's credit card bills. I thought, God, how much has been stolen from me? You know, $3 at a time from people like this so that I have not looked at the fine details of my charges. I never do, okay? Because I just look, you know, generally like, oh, okay, $800 worth of charges this month. That's about right, okay? I don't go down through the details. And he says, yeah, people don't do that. And that's how he did it. There can be situations where the motivation is sufficiently asymmetrical where you're going to get deceived because that's how it's tipped. In a situation of a male trying to figure out what a female's sexual psychology is, we would expect that he would be pretty good at smoking this out before he would wind up heavily somehow invested in such an individual. So would be pretty hard for her to deceive him for very long. I'm sure there's exceptions, but I think that those there's a big difference also between quote female promiscuity and somebody in a course of a long-term relationship that might have had an affair somewhere along the line and worked extremely hard to cloak it and did. So that I think that happens quite often because again, if the person who is having the affair considers their existing situation with their existing partner to be really highly valuable for whatever number of reasons, they can be under a tremendous amount of incentive to cloak this. And so that's not the same thing as trying to cloak, quote, promiscuity. That is a highly motivated deception under a particular set of circumstances. And that, you know, I think a lot of times that's hard to detect. If you do detect it, you're probably right. That's what the evidence shows us. But there's probably times when people never know.
Wow.
All right. Yeah.
It's encouraging in a way that you can trust your instincts, trust your feelings in certain
things. Right. That's actually well said, Nathan. That's kind of, what it is that I tried to say in, you know, 10,000 words. Right. That your instincts are generally quite trustworthy. Yeah.
All right. Excellent, Dr. Lyle.
Good.
Well, thank you so, so much. We really appreciate this appreciate the analysis of the Johns Hopkins study a little bit as well, and then the rest of the questions. So next show, we're going to look forward to having Dr. Hawk on solo. So Dr. Lyle, you get a little break, and then we'll have you both on again after that. And hopefully the world doesn't turn to shit until then.
No, it should be fine. I think we're going to be all right. All right, Nathan. Well, thank you very much, and we'll see you really soon.
Very good. Dr. Lyle, thank you so much, so much, so much, and we'll talk to you very soon, too. Have a good night.
All right, everybody.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.